On April the 21st, Dr. Anthony Turton, then with the University of Free State, wrote a very well-read think piece on BizNews where he took his observations in the African bush and applied it to politics. And particularly the way that the animals feed at a kill. He'll give us more insights there and tell us what he expects from the hyenas, Jacob Zuma's MK, in the next little while. Anthony, I think every South African who's had the privilege of going into the bush just absolutely loves it. It's a way of de-stressing and reminding yourself that you're a pretty small part of the big boss's creation. But I love the way you used your observations there of a kill and the hierarchy of a kill and applied that into the political situation. For those who perhaps haven't read the piece that you wrote for us, do you want to just take us through it very briefly, how you saw that and the analogy that you used then with the ANC, EFF and MK?
Yes, so good afternoon to you, the listeners. Pleasure to be with you. I'm at the privilege of growing up in the bush. I'm a 12th generation African, and my father was a big game hunter, so I spent a lot of time in the bush as a child, and subsequently in the special operations unit in the defense sector, let's call it that. And I'm a firm believer that what humans do is very often replicated in nature. We've done nothing more than just replicate things that are processing happening out there. And I happen to be a trained observer of things. And I've observed that in the chaos of a kill in the African bush, there is, in fact, a lot of order. There's a logical hierarchy. There's a pecking order. And as brutal as it is, if you understand that logic, you can predict. So I've always been in the business of prediction. I'm a former intelligence officer. And my role was to try observe things and make reasonably accurate predictions just to advise decision makers about what's coming their way. So what I noticed is that at a kill, there's definitely a hierarchy. The highest hierarchy is typically the lion, apex predator, could be a leopard, could be a cheetah. But they are first on the kill, but they are very rapidly followed by vultures that drop out of the sky. And then, of course, you get your hyenas, and they are followed very rapidly by the jackals. And when all of that is squabbling is done, they each get to their turn at the carcass, and then you get the maggots. The maggots come in as the final little bit to pick it all up. And this struck me as a very strong analogy for the South African economy, because post-liberation, the South African economy has really been a feeding place. There's been very little value added. There's been a lot of consumption and a lot of squabbling amongst the lions, the jackals, the hyenas, and the vultures to see what they could get of the carcass. And, of course, that carcass is now giving way to the role of the maggots, because the maggots take what the hyenas and the vultures and the jackals are unable to take. So that's where we are today. Now, as to which party is which of those animals, that's an open discussion. But I just think, the point of departure is that I think we are seeing South Africa as an economy being cannibalized. I don't see any coherent policy documents coming forward to suggest that we need to grow the economy, to create jobs, to attract capital back into the economy. So it's all about consumption. And if it's about consumption, then the politics is all about who gets access to the carcass, for how long can they feed. But no one gives thought to what's going to happen when that carcass is now so desiccated and dried up that only the maggots can feed on it. That, I think, is the big strategic question that we need to apply our minds to.
Of course, nobody gives too much or pays too much attention to the people of the country. As Bobby Godsell beautifully put it in an interview with me once, we are cursed by our governors, those predators, and blessed by our people. Perhaps the people have spoken in this last election. It was a huge turn up for the books for many people. For those of us who've been watching it more closely, not so much so. But now we've got a situation where there's the MK party and the EFF who initially were invited into a government of national unity. If I listen carefully to what you say, and having read your piece already, it would have been a disaster if you have three types of predators fighting over the kill rather than somebody trying to, or an organization, which governance should be, is trying to create wealth and prosperity.
Yes, well, let's look at carefully what the recent election has told us. So the first thing that the recent election has told us is that there is no dominant party in South Africa. In other words, South Africa is fragmented. It's home to, or become an ecosystem to multiple parties. I don't know how many, but certainly a lot of them around 20, plus minus, I don't know what the exact number is. But of those, there are sort of three that are reasonably dominant, but none of them have got a majority. So the elections that deliver us what we kind of suspected beforehand, and in this context, the constitutional democracy has worked. It's delivered us a credible outcome. However, now let's look a little bit deeper. The first thing that's happened is that the ruling party, in other words, the ANC, that has been the hegemonic party since 1995, is no longer in a driving position. And, of course, this is of great importance because we've seen the emergence of a brand new party, the MK party, which is nothing more than the internal structures or at least part of the internal guts of the ANC, in fact, part of the armed wing of the ANC. And we can drill down to what that means as well, because that's also got very, very significant consequences, because in which functioning democracy in the world do you have any political party that has got an armed wing that is protected, that you cannot touch, that is not accountable to anything. So this part, that aside, we can talk about that later, about the armed wing. And let's assume now that armed wing has now either turned on its host and defected to the new party, the MK party, or we can also think, assume that some of the, let's call it the fighters, the freedom fighters, are still within the ANC, which means effectively that the ANC is at war with itself. It's been cannibalized by its own people. So that's an interesting concept in its own right. Then, of course, there's another very, very interesting thing that is a very big taboo subject in South Africa. We're not allowed to talk about it, but I'm going to mention it now as delicately as I can. And that is the mythical belief that the ANC has managed over time to blur the lines between, let's call it, tribal allegiances. So the whole idea of nationalism, of let's call it by its name, Zulu nationalism, as a particular brand of nationalism, which I know the ANC is very, very, very loath to talk about. But of course, this is the elephant in the room, because effectively what we now see is that the MK party has got a very strong foothold in KZN, home of the Zulu people. It is headed by a very prominent homeland Zulu, let's call it what it is, a warlord, who was used during the 1980s by the ANC to, in fact, bring about peace between what was then the ongoing and festering low-intensity civil war between the armed factions of the IFP and the armed factions at that point in time of the UDF. So Zuma emerged at that point in time as a warlord capable of bashing heads together and capable of actually bringing an ANC into the party, because the ANC had been marginalized in case at that point in time. So there's that factor. We can park that and we can talk about that if you want to. And then, of course, there's another very, very interesting factor. That is that because the ANC until recently was in power but no longer in control, that is a concept that I put forward after the 2021 Looters' War, when I called it before it happened. I suggested that the Looters' War was about to happen, and I pulled the trigger. I went public on the fact that I believed it was going to happen. And, of course, the big unanswered question in that Looters' War, still not being dealt with to this day, another elephant in the room, is the role of the State Security Agency. Did the SSA know about the Looters' War and do nothing about it, in which case there are consequences, because we've now got a multi-billion rand agency of state security that failed in its job. In other words, is it being held accountable for not being able to give the prior forewarning? That's the one option. The other option is, was it potentially a part of that thing? In other words, was it a participant in that process? And if it was a participant, then we need to, at another T-junction, we ask another bunch of interesting questions, and that is that to what extent leadership of the SSA sympathetic to the Zuma faction, to the MK faction. And this is a really, really interesting can of worms that we're now talking about, because we can zoom in a little bit further and we'll see that one of the former Zuma aligned leaders within the SSA is the very same person that that laid the criminal charge against the then sitting president of the United States over the Pala-Pala, of South Africa over the Pala-Pala. So he's a, are those alliances still there? Where does the State Security Agency stand in this whole thing where there's now going to be a government of national unity? Who's it going to recognize? Is it a party? Is it a player in the field in its own right? Or is it just going to be a neutral bystander? That's an interesting question. And then, of course, we go to yet another interesting question now, and that is the question of the relationship between Zuma and his elites and the Russian intelligence services, the role that they might have played, the role that they might still play in the future, you know, what the consequences are, what the ramifications are in terms of state security, and, of course, in terms of the overall economy. So, in other words, what I've sketched to you here is a very complex issue that I would describe as an onion with many, many layers to it. And as we scratch the outer surface of the onion, you know, we start coming to the next layer of that onion and we open up another can of worms. So what I've given you is at least five different, different issues there, all of which I believe need some very sober reflection of some very smart people before they make decisions about the future of the South African economy. Because all of these have got ramifications and all of them have got unknowns. But all of them are relevant factors, but we cannot predict at this point in time how those factors are going to play out. So that's part of my introduction to the conversation.
Massive complexities that you have outlined there, and I guess we could spend our 20 minutes on each one of them and not get to the end of it. But Anthony, you are an academic as well. You will have some thoughts perhaps of an upside in all of this. Clearly, it's very easy to see the downside. It's easy to see how Jacob Zuma, the wrecking ball, will just wreck the country in whatever way that he wants to in a different context. But now that the ANC appears to have sobered up, perhaps opened its eyes and realizes that the government of national unity with MK and the EFF is not likely to have any longevity, and that it is now looking to get together with the DA and the IFP, is that something that could last and indeed be a bulwark against those very obvious dangers that you've outlined?
Well, being an inherently optimistic person and being a glass half full kind of guy, I would certainly like to support that idea. So in other words, a government of national unity served us very well in 1995. That served us for a period of time that was the transition in my professional life from National Intelligence Service to the South African Secret Service, which I was a founding member at that stage. So I had very close insight into how the GNU functioned there, and particularly from a national security perspective. So yes, let's assume on the high side that the government of national unity can hold itself together. It can find some kind of common ideological platform, which I can't easily see happening, but nonetheless, let's assume that that does happen. And let's assume that there can at least be some agreement between these different parties on the critical issue, which is, I would say, the restoration of the rule of law. That, to me, is the prime issue. If you can restore the rule of law, which implies the respect of the constitution. So if you can act according to the constitution and start to restore the rule of law, then the next logical thing that will come out of a government of national unity would be some sort of restoration of investor confidence, and therefore we might start seeing a reversal of the current outflow of foreign direct investment. Because until we can reverse that outflow, I don't see the economy stabilizing in any way. So I think the government of national unity is certainly the best option that we have of achieving that outcome. So let's assume that that now happens. We can now start seeing a return of some sort of investor confidence. Then we can start talking about job creation. But before we talk about job creation, we now have to talk about the other ugly elephant in the room, and that is the whole BEE legislative framework and the impact that has on investors. So yes, one thing to say to investors, yes, we will be stable. We want you to come back. It's another thing now when they come back and we now impose laws on them about the equity ownership and revolving doors and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure you've done many countless interviews. So whether there's enough political appetite to go that route is an open question. And so that's all on the upside. On the state security risk side, I think there's a very, very important issue that I'd like to raise now. That is that with that configuration, with that architecture of power, you've got NK and EFF outside the tent as marginalized actors. And what you're effectively doing then is you're incentivizing them to make the country ungovernable because that's the only power that they can wield. And, of course, you know, given the fact that, you know, that a government of national unity is inherently unstable. It's a coalition government. Coalition governments are very well known all over the world to be inherently unstable unless you have some very, very deep sort of sense of national identity or, you know, political unity, which we don't have in South Africa. We're a highly fragmented society. So in other words, if that's the case now, then what will the law and order, let's call it that, for, you know, rather than national security or state security issues, what will the law and order prospects be to bring those parties to book if and when they should break the law, you know, by making the country ungovernable? So, you know, is there a political will to sort of step in fairly strongly from the law and order perspective? There's that interest in both cases, both the EFF and NK, is to challenge the validity of the Constitution. So their activities will probably be best located in an analytical sense outside of your parliamentary democratic processes. So if, you know, if it's intra-parliamentary, then you deal with all your tensions through parliamentary processes by respecting the Constitution. But if you feel alienated by that, by the Constitution, and you see the Constitution as the problem, which is what the Zuma faction sees, they want to basically do away with the Constitution, as does the EFF. They want to do away with the Constitution because they see the Constitution as an impediment, which then means that we ultimately come down to a constitutional crisis. That constitutional crisis, on the one hand, will have the commercial interests, the commercial business interests, that either prop up the government of national unity or try and get whatever deals they possibly can out of the thing, or to try and attract capital, because we need to attract capital. They're going to get that on the one hand, versus on the other hand, you're going to get the forces that are going to try and undermine the Constitution and replace it with something else, in which case, of course, there's low investor confidence under that scenario. So this is the reality we have to deal with. And I think from an analytical perspective, what we want to start looking for over time is to see, firstly, how the different portfolios are allocated to the different parties on the assumption that these can kind of outbalance each other. You know? And the critical ones there, I would say, is finance, Finance, the Department of National Security, wherever that falls under, that might fall under a different government department now. I think that's critically important. Only that's possibly the one that's going to overthrow the apple cart or keep the apple cart together. And then, of course, defense. If defense is in a different ministry, that's another matter. And healthcare, health and infrastructure. Those are the big sort of main issues that we're going to be confronted with. Finance, big one. I mean, what about the fiscal cliff? How are we going to deal with a fiscal cliff under these circumstances? And what role will the fiscal cliff play, on the one hand, to either feed into the anarchy and chaos by the extra parliamentary forces, or on the other hand, feed into the capacity of the government of national unity to hold itself together? So you know, this is sort of the architecture that I've laid out for you now. I think is probably going to be, in my professional opinion anyhow, the sort of framework in which we're likely to see things unfold over the next couple of months, maybe next couple of years.
So fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bit of a rocky ride. But on the upside, Anthony, on the upside, we did have the 2021 July riots, which were instigated, which were an attempt at anarchy, at sedition, and they were unsuccessful. And there was no support from the police or the Defense Force, if they'd been around, maybe things might have been quelled even quicker. But it does appear as though the middle class in South Africa is not going to stand idly by, and it showed in that instance that it didn't. So who knows? It's an interesting conundrum that we face in South Africa. The upside, you said you're someone who sees the glass half full rather than half empty. How long might it take for this kind of turbulence to sort itself out, and indeed for international investors to start feeling that their cowardly capital can return to South Africa and start getting the economy growing?
Yes, okay. Can I answer the first question first and then the second question, if I may? So the first question, yes, I think you're entirely correct. 2021, the Looters' War, I think was a critically important time for South Africa. So let's quickly unpack what my perception of the Looters' War was. Remember, I'm just one person. I lived in KZN at that point in time. I was very close to where the action was playing. So let's unpack that. So the first thing that I saw in the Looters' War was, number one, that the state was completely unprepared. The state, so in other words, whatever agencies were responsible for forewarning, in other words, in this context, legally, that's the state security agency. So they did not see anything coming. And that opens a question, because when I put out my Facebook post saying that I think it's going to happen next week, I was clearly ahead of them, and I'm formerly one of them. So if I could do it with my limited resources, why couldn't they do it with their billions of rands worth of resources? So that's the one question. You know, the capacity to forewarn simply does not exist. The second, I think, very, very good thing that came out of the very good thing I'm telling you was there were deliberate attempts made, very sophisticated attempts made to sabotage critical pieces of infrastructure, and that's what made me believe that this is a highly, highly planned event at that point in time. It was not a spontaneous uprising, and I've subsequently been doing a lot of professional work for insurance industry on that matter, because there's certain insurance payout implications for what I've just said. Is it a political uprising or is it crime? You know, if it's burning up uprising, at least one thing, it's crime is another thing. So that's an important factor. But the third important factor for me was that there were deliberate attempts made by what appeared to be a sophisticated organization behind the scenes to lubricate the cleavage line of race in South Africa. And that failed. That failed. And if anything, you saw the racist closing ranks. And if anything, here the Zulu King played a critical role. Because when there were attempts made to inflame racial opinions in the Indian communities, it was the Zulu King that came out and said, no, this is not so. So in other words, that's very important. And so that Zulu factor, once again, you know, how united are they? That's an important factor to understand here. But then, of course, the next factor that came out of the Looters' War was So the next fact that came up was the fact that clearly the security forces were unable to respond, either unwilling or unable to respond. So here there's a lot of empirical data. The one is that, for example, many of the police either remained in barracks, and in some cases they ran out of ammunition. So now that's a very important factor, because in all cases, it was not the police that made a difference. It was what I've now given the word, and some people have taken offense to the word I'm going to use now. I referred to the emergence of armed militia. But you saw a militia emerging, and I saw it with my own eyes, and those militia were either organized in terms of private security companies, or they were just spontaneous for example, in the Mfanga area. There was a spontaneous organization that was not organized in any way at all, but that just emerged, and leadership was taken over almost naturally by a democratic process of SADF veterans that had seen combat before and that were very familiar with command and control roles. And that happened very, very quickly, and particularly in Mfanga area, where there was an epicenter of those attacks on large warehouses. But then we saw a third thing that happening now, and that is that we saw a militia, particularly a Muslim-related militia, emerging in certain places. And I saw with my own eyes what, for example, a Toyota body with automatic weapons on the back, and driving around with impunity while the police were just watching. So in other words, what came out of that looters war was a clear indication that the ruling party, the ANC, was in power but not in control. And in fact, the control has now shifted over to private militia, to armed militia. Now, whether those militia are aligned politically, I mentioned now this Islamic one, is that going to become part and parcel of kind of an Islamic movement, ISIS type of thing? You know, is this an open question? We don't know. We also have seen the private security companies that have grown and in many cases have now taken over a lot of the responsibilities of the police. And then, of course, we saw another factor happening at that point in time, and that was the deployment of the SANDF. And the SANDF came too late. The vehicles very often broke down. The vehicles were ill-equipped. In other words, the whole logistical planning and management and provision of ammunition and provision of diesel fuel and food and the stuff that keeps frontline troops sliding unhappy, that was not present. So in other words, we clearly saw the limitations there of both the army and the police force. So that all came out of that looters war. And there's another element, and that's a fairly unknown one, and that is that the role of the motorbike community, because the motorbike community is also kind of in the background as an organized mobile force that could potentially be rolled out in some way or other. So these are all the little loose bits and pieces that are floating around in the soup. And if anything, I would say that they are all collectively now more powerful than the state, if you look at them collectively. And therefore, there's kind of like a truce, there's kind of like a coalition between those militia and the state. And I would say that it's them that's going to make a difference in the future. And so we've got to watch those. And of course, finally, this is the final point about the looters war. To our very great surprise, the average South African generally looks at the taxi industry with some sort of disdain because of their general lawlessness. However, in this context, the taxi industry came down on the side of the militia and tried to restore law and order. So the taxi industry, I think, is also one that plays a very interesting role going forward, you know, in terms of stability. So in summary, just if I can summarize this whole thing now, on the upside, I see the government of national unity being held together by the way that it enters into a kind of agreement with these armed militia and the way that it kind of controls them, although it hasn't got the instruments of control in its hands anymore, but the way that at least forms alliances with those armed militia to at least sort of help to maintain law and order. And if that holds, if those armed militia do not become vigilantes, that's another thing to watch for. At any moment in time, an armed militia crosses over the threshold from being a kind of semi-legitimate armed militia in a local area, but when it crosses over now to become a vigilante, that's a very fine line. And I think then the potentially positive roles of those militia starts breaking out, you know, into a destructive thing. So what I'm sketching for you is a very delicate balance of forces. And if the government of national unity can hold those balance of forces together and forge the necessary alliances with these players that I've sketched out here now, then I see a slow, gradual return of investor confidence. It would be a slow, gradual thing. Investors would be a little bit concerned about the unpredictability of the situation. But I do see under those circumstances at least some possibility of holding the middle ground. And then once again, let me just highlight the fact that the common enemy of all of us, the common enemy of every single South African, irrespective of color, race, political persuasion, is the fiscal cliff. If the fiscal cliff hits or not, if when the fiscal cliff hits, it is going to be a catastrophic event for business, for state employees, for the entire economy. So the fiscal cliff is not in our best interest. We have to avert that as best we can, and hopefully the government of national unity at least starts talking about that, at least starts putting together some constructive policies that can guide their endeavors under very difficult circumstances.
Dr. Anthony Turton is an analyst, as you see, with a background in security and academia. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.